Today on Enduring Word with David Guzik, pastor of Calvary Chapel, Santa Barbara.
Jesus is the answer as well, because when his love and his word are received and spread abroad in a society, such things don't happen, or they don't happen with nearly the frequency. And Jesus is the answer, because if our society rejects him more and more, don't pretend to be shocked at the results. Most importantly, Jesus is the answer to transform your heart and your life.
Jesus is the answer for all the evil in society. Jesus is the answer for the poor we see in the streets. Jesus is the answer to the corruption in business and in government. Jesus is also the answer to our own life. Pastor David reminds us that when we see the deterioration of the world, we need to remember that God already sent a solution. Jesus died to redeem us from all the sins we could commit. And that compels us to live better lives. We need to spread that message far and wide. Now, here's Pastor David with his continuing study in the book of Exodus.
There are many people, when they see some infamous evil that's spread abroad in the press, that's on the cable channels, 24 hours. When something like that comes, it really makes people face difficult questions. They ask like this, well, where is God in the midst of this? Now, I understand the heart behind that question. It's someone who's reaching out to God in the midst of tragedy and sorrow. But nobody should think for a moment that God is somehow to blame for this, as if God was sleeping on the watch. God's been there all along. It's the culture that's thumbed their nose at him. And then they turn around and say, where was God? I'll tell you where God was. God was given the Ten Commandments. We were the ones not listening to them. But know this as well. Nobody should think that our Christian faith is some kind of sanitized faith that can't stand the dirt and the evil and the tragedy and the sorrow of this fallen world. I'll tell you something. Christianity was born into a world that knew evil and tragedy and sorrow on a scale that we can hardly imagine in our own culture. Now, we rightly grieve and our hearts go out for the tragic death of some 30 people in Connecticut. And it's terrible. It's an evil tragedy. But I think of something that happened not far from Nazareth, where Jesus of Nazareth grew up. When Jesus was about 11 years old, there was a widespread rebellion against the Roman government centered in Galilee. And the rebels took control of a city named Sepphoris. It was only 4 miles from Nazareth, a very short distance from Jesus' house of residence. And in Sepphoris, when they launched this rebellion against the Roman government, the Roman legions responded and they crushed it. And when they crushed it, not only did they level the city of Sepphoris, not only did they kill so many innocents in overwhelming the city, not only did they take every surviving woman and child and sell them into cruel slavery, but they took 2,000 men from Sepphoris. Some of them guilty, some of them innocent. They took 2,000 men from the city of Sepphoris and they crucified them all along the roads in the area. There's an 11-year-old boy, Jesus, walking down the road and he sees hundreds of men hanging on crosses. He sees murder and injustice and evil on a scale that we would regard as almost unimaginable. And he realizes that God has given him the place to come in and to redeem society and to redeem men and women, to change a culture by changing individual lives, by bringing godly influence, by transforming things. And are we not the inheritors of this? And so we bless the name of the Lord, but we realize as people ask these dangerous or these despairing, I should say, they're not dangerous questions, they're despairing questions. Where is God in the midst of it? I'll tell you what we say. We answer back without hesitation. We say that Jesus is the answer. Jesus Christ brings comfort and peace in the most impossible circumstances. I'll say this as well. Jesus is the answer in another sense. He's the answer in the sense that he will judge the guilty and they will answer to him for their crimes against his little ones. Make no mistake about it. Some people may think that in some case like this, where some evil man goes and he murders a bunch of people and then turns the weapon of his destruction upon himself so that he can be held to account in no human court of law, that somehow he's escaped justice, not for a moment. He hasn't escaped it at all, but rather he's been put into the hands of the ultimate judge, Jesus Christ himself. Jesus is the answer as well, because when his love and his word are received and spread abroad in a society, such things don't happen, or they don't happen with nearly the frequency. And Jesus is the answer, because if our society rejects him more and more, don't pretend to be shocked at the results. Most importantly, Jesus is the answer to transform your heart and your life. Maybe there are some people here you have at some point in your life, you have in some way or another, you have violated this command in your action. I would say there's probably almost every person in this room, we have violated it in spirit. Because did not Jesus speak to us very directly and say that this commandment prohibits not only the action of murder, but the heart of murder, the heart of hatred and indifference? The heart that would leave people to their own destruction. The heart that would condemn people to a hell if it could do it. No, Jesus told us, this commandment tells us not only not to murder, but also not to hate. We look at this and we go, Lord, I'm a commandment breaker. Verse 14. You shall not commit adultery. Boy, it's simply said, isn't it? Right there, I look at it and it's just five words. You shall not commit adultery. And clearly here, the act itself is condemned. God allows no justification for the ways that we creatively justify the breaking of our marital commitments. It's not to be done. And when it is done, it's sin. And you know what else it does? It damages. It's not a victimless crime. It damages. Now, the Bible does make the distinction between, for example, in the Mosaic law, the punishment for adultery and the penalty for extramarital sexual relationships. They're different sins, but they're related. Here, most specifically, is the violation against the marital bond. You shall not commit adultery. And again, I'd just like you to consider for a moment, think of what it would be like if this command would be obeyed. What a different world it would be. Think of how many attorneys would be out of business if this command were obeyed. Now, if you look at this and you say, well, I haven't obeyed this commandment, you can repent. You can call it for what it is. It must be just by the law of averages that I'm speaking to people right now. And you're in an adulterous relationship, or you're on your way to one. If we were to sit down and discuss it over a cup of coffee, and you tried to justify the reasons why, maybe it would fall into two categories. Maybe some of you, it's frivolous. It's a curiosity. It means nothing. You're just hyped up with lust and with foolishness. Let's just call it's just foolish. You're being foolish. And could I just say, you're being foolish? Don't be foolish. Don't go on this path to your own destruction. Think of how much you have to lose. Don't be a fool. You think you can justify it in the name of novelty or curiosity or nobody will find out or I won't get caught. Don't be a fool. Then I think there's another group that you would talk to them about them and they would say, no, I'm not being foolish. I love that person. You see, honestly, I just don't love my own spouse much anymore. That love seems to have gone cold. It's mundane. I don't want it anymore. But I want what I seem to have with this new person. There's a spark there. There's something amazing. And do you know what I would say to that person? I would say it as gently as I could but I say it as firmly as necessary. I'd try to look him in the eye and I'd say, Jesus called you to lay aside lesser loves for his glory. I can't try to debate whether or not you really love that person, but I will tell you this, that if you'll obey Jesus, if you'll do what he said and lay down before him the things that dominate your heart and let him really be the Lord of your life in this area, God will bless you for it and God will honor you for it. You're on a path that will not lead to good, but only to error. And then we think about it, we think, wow, the New Testament spoke of this, Jesus did in the Sermon on the Mount, not only in the act itself, but also in the heart that desired the act. And then we say, we're all covenant breakers. We're all guilty under this covenant. The New Testament puts it this way. It says in Galatians chapter 5, now the works of the flesh are evident, which are adultery, fornication, uncleanness, licentiousness. That pretty much covers it. That God has given a beautiful plan for the power and the greatness of sexual relationship, for it to be the power and the bonding force, or at least one of them, that bonds together this beautiful one flesh relationship that God intends in marriage. And when you take that power, when you take that force and put it outside of the bounds of marriage, it wreaks more destruction than anything else. So we say, God, God, here we are, covenant breakers, would you please come and speak to our hearts. Verse 15, the eighth commandment. You shall not steal. You know what I find so amazing about these commandments? If we come back to that picture of a guardrail and just think, honor your father and mother, don't murder, don't commit adultery, don't steal. These are absolute foundational building blocks for a healthy society. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a command that's extremely important to say you shall not steal because it basically lays out the right to personal property. It says that God has entrusted certain things to certain people, and if I take it as if it's mine, that's stealing. It's not mine. It's yours, so it belongs to you. If you give it to me, fine, but if I take it without permission, that's theft. Why is it theft? Because it belongs to you and not to me under God's ordinance. Don't steal. Think about how great it would be if this command were obeyed. Think about living in a community, once again, where you didn't have to lock your front door. Live in a community where you can park on the street, run into the store, and you leave your keys in the car. It's just no big deal. You don't have to worry about it. Oh, what a wonderful thing that would be. But I want you to think about this in another term. You see, we can also steal from God. Now, how do we steal from God? Well, of course, there's one sense in which we steal from God, and when we refuse to honor him with our financial resources. In Malachi chapter 3, that's spoken of very directly, where God said, you're robbing me if you don't honor me with what you have. Now, that's one way to rob God, but I'll tell you, there's an even greater way that we rob God, by refusing to give him ourselves for obedience and for his service. See, this is the idea. We belong to him. We are his purchased possession. He bought you. He owns you. Stop acting like you own yourself. It's stealing from him. How about this one from 1 Corinthians chapter 6? He says this, for you were bought at a price. Therefore, glorify God and in your body and in your spirit, which are God's. You're bought with a price. He owns you. Therefore, give him your life. If you don't, it's a form of stealing. I like what it says in Ephesians chapter 4, verse 28. Here's the real solution to stealing. It says this, let him who stole steal no longer, but rather let him labor, working with his hands what is good, that he might have something to give him who has need. Wasn't that amazing? Here's God's solution for stealing. Working. Work. And then you'll have something not only to give restitution to those that you've stolen from, but to be a giver. You speak to any person, even if you're speaking to yourself, speak to any person who's a thief, and there's shame in being a thief. Why don't you get beyond that shame and work with your hands so that God could say, no, that person is no longer a stealer, now they're a giver. That's a beautiful transformation. The ninth commandment, verse 16. You shall not bear false witness against your neighbor. Now, the primary sense of this command has to do with the legal process. The idea is there you are in a court of law and evidence is being heard. And when you testify, you gotta tell the truth. And I think that it has its primary and most pointed application of that. But we could say this, could we not? That every day we speak in an informal court. Every day we speak in situations where what we say is taken seriously and truth or error matters are set before us and others to decide. So we can break this commandment in a lot of ways. You can break this commandment through slander. You can break it through talebearing. You can break it through creating false impressions. You can break it by questioning the motives behind someone's actions. You can break it by flattery. I'll tell you another way you can break it, by silence. Sometimes your silence is a lie because it creates a false testimony in somebody else. Think of what the difference would be if this command were obeyed. If we did that, not only the Old Testament, but the New Testament tells us to do. Look at it here. Colossians chapter 3, verse 9 says this. Do not lie to one another so that you put off the old man with his deeds. We just told the truth. Lying and false representations, all that belongs to the old man and not to the new life that we have in Jesus. Ladies and gentlemen, what a beautiful thing it is for us to walk in the truth of Jesus Christ. I like what Alan Redpath said on this point. He said, how very strange it is that we have come to think that Christian maturity is shown by the ability to speak our minds, when really it's shown in the ability to control our tongue. That is, isn't it? When the prophet Isaiah had his heavenly experience, and there he was before the throne of God, and he recognized his great sinfulness. What did he say? He said, I am a man of unclean lips, and I dwell in the midst of a people of unclean lips. Well, may God send that coal from his fire to touch what we say, that we would speak and represent the truth. The 10th commandment, verse 17, you shall not covet your neighbor's house, you shall not covet your neighbor's wife, nor his male servant, nor his female servant, nor his ox, nor his donkey, nor anything that is your neighbor's. You shall not covet. I find this fascinating because coveting is something that primarily happens in the heart, in the mind. I mean, murder begins in the heart and mind, but it's an action. The same with adultery, the same with theft. But coveting, that is something that happens in the heart and the mind, and God says, I care about that. I don't want you to be mastered by ungodly desires. That's what really the word means. It basically means to desire. And you shouldn't desire things that belong to other people, because covetousness works like this. Our eyes look upon an object, and then the mind admires it, and then the will goes over to it, and then the body moves to possess it. And just because you haven't taken that final step doesn't mean that you haven't started the first step in your heart and in your mind. And that covetousness, it's a wicked thing. It can be expressed towards all kinds of things, isn't it? He says there, your neighbor's house, his wife, his ox, his donkey, whatever. It all has the idea of an itch to possess what belongs to somebody else. And it communicates this, an essential dissatisfaction with what we have. And it's jealousy towards those who have something better. It's a terrible thing. It's a terrible thing when it's inflamed in the society, when covetousness and dissatisfaction is preached to us all over the place in our culture, in our society. Instead, God says, no, you shall not covet what your neighbor has. Jesus gave a special warning about covetousness, which explained the core philosophy of the covetous heart. Are you ready for this? He said this, take heed and beware of covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of the things he possesses. Isn't that one of the great errors of covetousness? You think that there's more life in things than there really is. Friends, no. The real source of life is God. It's in Jesus Christ himself. Listen, that's such an important verse. I'm going to read it again. This idea of covetousness, it is universal all over the world. Nobody should think that it's only the poor who are covetous or it's only the rich who are covetous. Everyone could be covetous. But if you would say this, should not this especially be read a second time in Santa Barbara? Take heed and beware of covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of things which he possesses. You heard it. You've been warned here. Your life does not exist in the things that you possess. It exists in Jesus Christ. You see, this is the great thing about that word that's translated covetousness here. At root, it's the word to desire, to pant after, to desire something strongly. And did you know that there are desires that God says, go for it with? But no, not desires that are covetous, that possess what other people have. Instead, why don't we begin with this? I'm not saying it ends with this, but let's begin with this, the desire after God himself. You see, haven't you done it your own way long enough? This life, imagine a life. It dishonors father and mother. If it doesn't commit the act of hatred, it has murder in its heart all the time. Committing adultery in one way or another. Stealing, bearing false witness, coveting everything. You look at that person, what a happy person, are they not? No. This is a person who has completely missed what God has for their life, and their life shows the pain of it. When you come down to it, these commandments are good. How much better the world would be if just one of these commandments were obeyed. Just take one. Take one of the six that we've covered. Take one of the six and give it a 90% compliance rate in our culture. Wouldn't it be a much better community to live in? These commandments also are helpful. God gave them for our good. He gave you these commandments not because he looked down from heaven, saw some people having fun, and said, I got to put a stop to that. God gave these commandments because he said, I know you. I know how I made you. I made you in my image. Your life is wired to live after the pattern of my moral perfection. This is the way you will have life and succeed. You depart from this, you go off on your own, and there's a lot of trouble and waste out there. Now, these commandments are helpful. This is the best way to live. This is the gift from God. But then I think these commandments were obeyed and fulfilled by only one person, by Jesus himself. Remember that one guy who came to Jesus and claimed that he had kept all the commandments? I wonder if Jesus laughed or if he had the divine miracle of holding back laughter at that moment. No, Jesus was the only one who kept these commandments. You and I? No. I don't mean to be too rough on you, but I'll do it anyway. I'm looking out upon an entire room of commandment breakers. I look at one in the mirror all the time as well. But isn't it amazing? We who have broken these commandments, we look to Jesus who never broke them, who kept them, who obeyed them, who fulfilled them in every aspect. And when Jesus Christ went to the cross, God treated the only commandment keeper as if he were the ultimate commandment breaker. And because the commandment keeper was treated as if he were a commandment breaker, we who put our faith and our trust in him, we are accounted as commandment keepers. Thank you, Jesus.
The book of Exodus is packed full of symbolism that points us to Jesus. From the 10 plagues poured out upon Pharaoh and all those in Egypt, to the crossing of the Red Sea, Jesus will take center stage as we study this book. And of course, one of the most prominent sections of this book is the giving of the Ten Commandments. Even Hollywood has made movies about this event. And as we know, God's instructions for our lives are never burdensome and always meant to bring blessing. We encourage you to join us each day as Pastor David teaches through the book of Exodus. You've been listening to Enduring Word, the radio ministry of David Guzik, pastor of Calvary Chapel in Santa Barbara, California. It's our hope and prayer that as you join us each day here on Enduring Word, that you'll be drawn closer to Jesus and that your life will reflect that growing relationship. We encourage you to log on to enduringword.com and review this message or share it with a friend. Today's message, as originally presented at Calvary Chapel in Santa Barbara, California, can be downloaded from our website at enduringword.com. If you can't get to your computer to download or place an order, you can always call us at 805-730-1400. We'll be happy to help you. Again, that number is 805-730-1400. Now please, place a marker in your Bibles and make plans to join us again. Pastor David will continue teaching verse by verse through the book of Exodus, right here on Enduring Word.